Right, well, here we are. We're back again, and I'll just have a look to see if any of my people. I've got a squad of people in the chat now. If you can loud and clear, there we look at that. they both had their little prompts, a little code word to shout out, because I always hate the start of streaming. But in case you get a technical hitch. Anyway, I have to say, folks, we're running our late because we had a bit of a mishap with the Endeavour's not in England, so we had the daylight savings thing, which is, and I've got to admit, it caught me out as well. I was having a nap on the settee, and I'd been out with the dog, and then all of a sudden, I was like, I wonder if something's happened where. You know, like, because I set it for a certain time, and then we had the daylight savings thing, and then it was like, well, I wonder if that's just playing away. I wonder if everybody's like just sitting listening to a dead stream. There's nothing. I hate technology. I'm useless with technology. And anyway, how are you doing, Endeavour?
I'm doing great. Sorry to everyone for delaying the stream by an hour. Sorry, you know, different time zones, and when the time changes, it changes in some countries, it doesn't in others. It's always on a different day, so that's on me. But we're here now, and I'm sure this will be a good stream.
Yeah, I mean, I've said one of the things that we've touched on there's a running theme on classic movies, because what comes up a lot is what is your favorite film of all time. And what one of the things that the rule of thumb that I've, I mean, people are pushing back on Twitter, because I get reply guys now because I'm back on Twitter. But people, you know, you get, I'm open to push back again. And this idea where when you ask somebody what their favorite films are, they'll always tell you something highfalutin. And then when you say, well, okay, well, what movies have you watched the most? It's like RoboCop and Lord of the Rings or Empire Strikes Back. Or in my case, it's First Blood. And I think in terms of the movies that I've watched the most will be probably the Rockies, the First Blood. But Mad Max is up there. Mad Max may well be the most watched films for me of all time. So much so that this is the first time that I watched Mad Max 1 again last night. But I literally know like almost every line of dialogue in these movies, especially the second one. And maybe I'll do a bit. Maybe I'll do a bit of the gyro captain, or maybe a bit of toe cutter as the stream goes on. Let's dive into Mad Max 1 then, because we do have a lot to get through here. What were your general impressions of Mad Max 1?
Well, they were good in short. I had never seen any of the Mad Max films before preparing for this stream, so. I'm coming into this new to the series, but my impressions of them were good. I think I liked all three of them to varying degrees. And what I do appreciate about them is that each of them is a different film. So one thing I think they did really well was that you see the post-apocalypse or the collapse kind of advancing each within each film. So the first one is not nearly as apocalyptic as the second and then the third. So you kind of see, as you would expect, if there was a collapse of some kind, over time, you'd get further and further away from the previous civilization, which no longer exists. So on the first Mad Max film, I thought it was really good. It was a fun action movie. It was, you know, it's brilliantly shot. And it's a low budget movie. I watched a video about it today where they said that it was only made for a couple hundreds of thousands of Australian dollars back in the day, and that it ended up making over 100 million. So I do love these budget movies where they can make a good movie on a budget. I always appreciate that. And yeah, Mad Max was a good example of that, a great action movie.
I'll just point out as well that we have now got special effects on classic movies, as you can see here. Everybody, just look at that. Look at that screen. So we've gone for 2 years and 24 episodes of Classic Movies, and I've only just figured out how to get images onto the screen. So on Mad Max 1, then, I mean, it begins a few years from now. That's what comes up at the start. And, I mean, I think people are going to be more or less aware of the storylines. I get the impression from the chat that everybody's aware, like everybody knows the general gist of the Mad Max movies. But what it is, you can see these special effects are very special. You cut my channel, this is as good as it's going to get, I'm afraid. But what you see is there's a kind of, it's supposed to be a general decay where bikers are taking over the roads and everything. And, you know, I'm not going to start bashing Mad Max. Don't worry about that. But I couldn't help but notice that I'd still rather live in the dystopia of Mad Max 1 than like modern day London or like New York or Detroit or something. I mean, it's a proper like ethno state. Fair enough, it's a bit wild on the roads, you know, but you don't have to go on the roads. You could go across country. But what they're going for is things very much are falling apart. And it's weird to see it because it is like monocultural, monoethnic. There's no diversity in this whatsoever. Yet still, I mean, you can get onto that, some of these things later on in the stream. Because the biker, it turns up the Knight Rider then has escaped prison and he's screaming through the highway with a stolen V8 interceptor, and he's got his all of the cops get wiped out. And eventually it ends up where Max is all that's left. And because he's kind of high as a kite, Max plays chicken with him and sort of phases him out. And it turns out that it's the first hint that there's something about Max which is like sort of almost as barbaric as the bikers themselves, the nomads as they call them. And so I think what that sets in motion is a tit for tat squabble between the road cops and the high speed patrol officers and the biker gang, which generally escalates, and you get some of the most spectacular car sequences, chase sequences that are ever put on film, like Endeavor says, for a budget as well. I mean, the first, right at the start of the movie, the way it begins, there's a scene where there's one of the cop cars just keeps getting more wrecked, but they're still in the game. And there's a bit where, you know, like they crash through the caravan. There's a little toddler in the middle of the road and the two cars are like 150 miles an hour and the kid survives. It's just great. I am going to praise it all the time. Like, so what that's kind of like how it begins. Knight Rider gets blown up, and the tow cutter come in because Knight Rider's the sort of the capo. He's like the chief of the gang, or at least sort of shares it with tow cutter, and then the rest of them come to town, and they're looking for revenge, and all hell breaks loose.
So I don't know if I would classify the first one as a post-apocalyptic movie. I'd probably classify it as an apocalyptic movie, or that rather than a post-collapse one, I'd say that in the first film, Australia is in the process of collapsing. So what you see is that they still have cars. I mean, that's the main theme of the movie, the driving on the roads. It's how all the action sequences are shot. They still have guns. In fact, they still even have ice cream. If you notice that part where they go to that little shop in town, his wife buys ice cream for their son. I remember even you wrote in an article something about like eating ice cream on the Titanic, like the amount of civilization you need to make that possible. So that's what crossed my mind with this scene about ice cream. So I feel like what you have in the film is that the first thing that has happened in this collapse is that the Australian state has lost its ability to maintain order, to uphold the law. So yeah. Now what you have is marauding gangs of bikers going around basically pillaging what is remaining of the industrial technologically advanced society that they live in. And Max, like the character of Max, he's kind of like the they even say in the movie that his police force is one of the last remaining police forces in Australia. Someone put in the chat, they still have police. So yeah, the police are, they still exist, but they're on their last legs. I think they even say that like most of the police forces were wiped out and like his is one of the last ones. Most of his colleagues end up getting brutally murdered or get horribly injured. And you see Max is kind of like the last gasp of order, the last kind of a stand for of a civilized society trying to fight back the forces of anarchy, which, you know, unfortunately, like anarchy actually does end up winning. But, you know, in the film, though, Max does he does do away with this one biker gang.
Yeah, and there's a bit in it where so you've got the toe cutter, you've got Bob Arcinetti, and then you've got Johnny the Boy, and Johnny the Boy is like he's truly psychotic, like he's really really sick. The toe cutter's kind of enigmatic, but Johnny the Boy is like he's a junkie, he's just rants. There's nothing likable about him whatsoever, but they attack a couple horribly, and it cuts away, but it's implied they were both raped, which is part of the sort of homoerotic thing that the bad guys have got going on in this throughout. We'll touch on that a bit later, but if you notice, he gets let out, and there's like shades of Dirty Harry, because it's like the bureaucrat says, well, you haven't, nobody showed. No, everybody was too scared to come and testify against the gang. So Johnny the Boy walks, and this incenses the cops, who know that he's going to go out and do it again. They feel helpless. And then Fifi, the chief, basically says, like, well, as long as the paperwork's clean, like, you can do whatever you want. At the start as well, when I don't know his name, but it's like the chubby fella who keeps crashing the car, one of the cops. When they get back in the game, they get the car up and running again. They're going after the Knight Rider. And he says, like, the Knight Rider and his skag, they're going to die. Like, he's like, they're not there to arrest them or take them into custody. They are there to kill them. They just want these scumbags dead. And it's a kind of saying that I think that the cops themselves, like law and order, is breaking down across the board. That the cops themselves are kind of becoming more barbaric and more, because they cannot cope. And this is what's implied. I mean, if he had a massive, much bigger budget, you may have seen sort of cities in decay or this kind of thing. But in a way, I think it's perfect just the way it is, because there's so much implied behind the scenes. There's a part of the road which is like sectioned off, and it's just like the forbidden zone, which you generally wouldn't see in a kind of standard liberal democracy. So the point is that law and order is breaking down really badly, and that's the point that he's making there. But we haven't yet gone in to like a full apocalypse. That's not there, but society's falling apart at the seams.
Yeah, and I would imagine that if law and order broke down in that way, so the state, the centralized authorities' ability to actually impose order is beginning to slip, that people are no longer obeying their laws. A police force that remains standing, I think, would probably become kind of a gang of its own. So what you do see in Mad Max is that, and then you'll see this later in the other films as well, that tribalism, like a reversion to tribalism, that people are now governed by whatever gang has the most power in any given area. And I think that what you'd probably see is that police forces, if they remained intact and they remained organized, they'd probably become a gang of their own. So they would become the authority over whatever territory they were able to maintain control of. Because if the centralized authority is gone, then they don't really have that. They wouldn't really have anything to remain loyal to, and they'd kind of just become a gang of their own. I mean, you kind of do see with Max that there is a theme that he goes from being Max to becoming Mad Max. That he, after his family is killed, and you're gonna have to forgive me that I don't know the names of all the characters.
It's Max's first crisis moment is when his best friend, the Goose, who's this really charismatic ladies' man, he's the cop with the bike. I mean, just to take a second as well, like one of the great ways that this is made, you see it with Max, like they're very. When you're introduced to Max, you don't actually see his face or anything. What you see is his hands covered in oil, and he's finally tuning the car and then rubbing the hands off the oil, and he's kind of messing around with the car. And it's weird because, and then when he actually gets into the car to go after the Knight Rider, you like standard practice in that kind of movie is to scream the car, like, you know, the wheels skidding and all of that. But the car just kind of rumbles, like, just out onto the road really slowly. It's as if he's like this sort of shark coming out of a cave, like on the prowl. And you've gone through this like whole ritual and ceremony of the car being prepped. And this is the way Max is introduced. And then later, when you see it with the Goose, it's something similar as well. Like, because I mean, as these movies are high octane, like they move at a hell of a clip, and they're not very long either. But I mean, especially when we come to Mad Max 2 in a bit. But what's great about the Goose's part when he's setting off on his fatal sort of trip on the bike is that, again, you see this, like it's really slows down, and you see him getting ready, you see him putting his boots on, and it just adds that some great tension to the film. And then there's just a long, long bit, like it's about 3 minutes, where he's just screaming along on the bike on these empty roads. And then I don't know what they do to it exactly, but the back wheel locks and he goes flying off. And I mean, eventually that's going to mean the toe cutter and Johnny the Boy burn him alive, because the toe cutter's testing Johnny as well. Like, he's saying, you're going to have to do this. It was the sort of a rites of passage, an initiation thing, where you're going to have to make your first kill. You're going to have to burn your enemy alive. And because the idea is there's no turning back from that. You know, you've got to cross that threshold, which he does. But and that has a kind of flip side, because that's kind of like Max reaching a first breaking point, where he goes in and tells Fifi that I can't go on with this circus. I'm being hollowed out by this horror, by this savagery and barbarism, and if I'm going to end up part of it, and I can feel myself slipping into it. And of course they give him a fancy car, and he gets lots of words. They give him a holiday. The holiday, it gets worse, because then it costs him his family. They buy a weird coincidence. They find it really accidental, and that leads to the death of his family. And then it's the full break. It's like the full break with any kind of human like decency. Well, that's the main arc of Max's character throughout all of the movies. We'll come on to that in a bit, but in Mad Max 1, you see the break where essentially he is just going to sort of allow himself to be as barbaric as they are, because that's the only thing that works.
Well, yeah, it's his transition from being a man of the pre-Claps world to being a man of the post-Claps world. You know, before the Claps, he could have been a cop who was a force for good, where he followed the law. He brought criminals to justice while not sinking to their level. And, being somebody who would have been considered a good man in the Australia before the crisis. But then after his kind of breakdown, first with what happened to Goose, and then the death of his family, he kind of becomes the man of the post-Claps world, where unless you are prepared to be as brutal as every scumbag out there, well, then they're just gonna kill you. You're not gonna survive unless you're tough, unless you actually learn to live in the new reality. And I feel like Max's transformation is him going from Max, the police officer, the good man who wants to contribute to a civilized society, to Mad Max, the wanderer of the post-apocalyptic wasteland, doing what he needs to do to survive.
You see it when he goes, because he goes to where they keep their bikes. They've got this like sort of ratty fella who does all of the maintenance on their bikes, and he pays him a visit. And it's the first time that you see Max kind of transformed. He goes through a thing where he's sitting and he gets the mask that he wore to play around with his family, Jesse, and the little kid. And he kind of just scrunches it up, and then he goes to get the leather gear and he gets in the car, and then that's it. And he, when he goes to see this fella, it's the first time you've seen him, like after his family have died, and the fella's under a car. And he's got this jack thing, and he asks the fella a question, and the fella gives him the brush off, and he just drops the car on the fella's ribs. And you think, whoa, he's like screaming. And then when you see him go out on the road again, he's just there to kill them. And it's so brutal, especially when there's some of the scenes. There's a bridge scene, which is quite famous, which I think, like, I mean, I don't know, some of the stuntmen in this, like, I do wonder if he ever walked properly after this. I mean, there's one where he chases them across the bridge, he turns around, they are just coming across the bridge, and then he goes at them head on, and they all scatter, and they all go over the side and whatnot. But there's a scene where one of them's sliding along on the floor, and the motorcycle's, like, doing a somersault thing behind him. And the front wheel, the front part of the motorbike, just cracks him right in the back of the head. I mean, you've got to hand it to some of these Aussie stuntmen on Mad Max. They really got put through it. And I kind of, the budget that they had, I can't imagine there being much in the way of padding and getting them pampered and all of that. So at any rate, That's kind of where it goes, and he hunts down the toe cutter and Johnny the Boy. Then come out again. It's a great sequence because they're like the top brass. All the minions have been. He's wiped them out, and what you're left with is Johnny the Boy, toe cutter, and Bobo Sanetti. And you see this scene, it's just so great, where you see like Toe Cutter and Bobo Sanetti on their bikes, like sort of riding in tandem, like screaming along on the roads. And it's like, these are the top brass. They have been called out to deal with this problem, you know? And they nearly get them. Like Mad Max gets kneecapped with a shotgun. Or is it a shotgun or a normal gun?
I think it was a shotgun, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and that will stay for the rest of the three movies. And I mentioned that because people were saying, well, you know, you can't ask, there isn't actually a coherent arc across the movies. Well, there clearly is. There clearly is. In when you get to Mad Max 2, he's wearing that brace on his leg. And even in Mad Max 3, you see that he's got the bandage still around his leg, but he's mysteriously able to run again on that one. But in Mad Max 2, he can hardly walk as a result of being shot with a knee, being kneecapped by Bobo Sanetti. And then the obviously there's the scene where, you know, when Toe Cutter, it's so fast, like, it's great. And then Toe Cutter just plows straight into the front of the of like a massive truck, and you get that thing where you get a close up of his eyes coming out of the door as he realizes like he's had it, as he sees the truck coming towards him.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that the violence in these movies, it's pretty hardcore for the days that it was made. And I do think it does suit the film. You know, I'm not someone that's a huge fan of gore in movies. I think that a lot of movies these days way overdo it. But I did like the violence in Mad Max. I did think it was an appropriate level, because it is meant to be like a brutal world. So I thought it was really cool. And that scene where like who was that? Was it Toe Cutter or was it the Knight Rider, the one that got hit by the truck?
The Toe Cutter gets hit by the truck.
Okay. Yeah, that scene's just brilliant. But what one thing though is that you see kind of that with Max's arc, something that kind of is different than a lot of other movies of a similar type is that basically he ends up killing the entire gang. He avenges his family, but at the end of the film though, anarchy still really kind of wins, because when we get the Mad Max 2, even more of civilization has disappeared. So he doesn't kill the gang and then save the town, and then like the sheriff in the old Wild West movies. Ultimately, the arc is that anarchy ends up winning. So it's kind of tragic in some ways.
Yeah, and Johnny the Boy as well. He does this thing where he handcuffs him to a. Johnny the Boy's obviously just murdered somebody in their pickup, and Max basically gives him a choice. You're gonna have to saw through your own ankle. It'll take 3 minutes for this fuse to blow up the tank and you with it, or you can saw through your own ankle and you'll escape. And then he just wanders off. You know, he limps off. And you can hear Johnny the Boy screaming in terror. And then, like, Max gets in the car and drives, and then you just see the explosion in the distance. And what kicks in then is, I think, because it's the end of the movie, but you get this weird... there's a little montage as well where Max is just driving through the night, driving through the rain, just on his own. And then towards the end of the movie, you see that as well. He's just driving alone, and it's the beginning of like Max as a sort of mythological figure almost, which becomes much more apparent in like Mad Max 2, where we can go to now.
Yeah, so that would be a good transition point. So with Mad Max 2, I think this one. I thought it was a bit better than the first one, for the fact that it was a truly post-apocalyptic movie. So in this one, civilization is completely gone. The theme of the first Mad Max movie, the overarching theme of the first one, I think, was anarchy. When law and order breaks down, when the central authority loses its ability to control the territory, what happens? It's anarchy. The main theme of the second movie, I would say, is scarcity. So now that Australia truly is a post-apocalyptic society, the remnants of civilization have been wiped out by the onslaught of anarchy. Everyone's kind of living in this primitive tribal state. So they now have, similar to the gang in the first movie, or what I mentioned with the police force, everyone is kind of grouped into these tribes. And your tribe is now your little society in the wasteland. And everyone's fighting over resources, primarily fuel. So I even remember thinking when I saw the first movie, what I thought was that wouldn't the fuel run out rather quickly? But with the second one, I was pleased to find out that was the main theme of the next movie. That now that the apocalypse has really come, the remnants of the modern society are now gone. Now everybody's struggling for fuel, and cars are now a very hot commodity. Being able to drive gives you power. Guns are becoming more rare. Ammunition is very scarce. So now we can kind of see the apocalypse a few I'm guessing it's a few years. I don't know if they say the exact date between the first two movies, but it's a few years down the road. And now you kind of see a real post-apocalyptic Australia.
Yeah, and I think Mad Max 2, in my opinion, has probably got the best intro. The first like 5 minutes is just like peak cinema for me. The first thing that happens is the tone since the first movie. The first movie was grim enough, but then in once Mad Max 2 begins, you hear this kind of the wind. I love it. You hear like the wind, and then there's this like really sort of apocalyptic adagio starts playing, and you hear the voice, and he just says, "My life fades," and he begins to tell the story of what happened to the world. And it is interesting. They use a lot of like footage from World War II. There's a lot of it black and white. There's sort of general chaos around the world, and so I mean, there's not much there. But what you do kind of get is this idea that the power, two mighty warrior tribes, as he says, fell out over resources, and it's heavily implied. Well, it's shown specifically that it is the oil. So it's as if the oil was running out, and then maybe America, Russia, or China started to go to war with each other over all of these resources. But I will say, George Miller, I think it is, he said that there's a problem why you don't get the impression so specifically that it's been like a nuclear war in what you do in other movies. And the reason why like he gave for that was because when you introduce nuclear warfare as a plot device in these kinds of films, the problem that you're left with is radiation. So your characters have to actually, whether they, like, everything will be poisoned, it becomes all about protecting yourself from radiation. And you can see that wasn't really what he wanted to do. It's more like civilization has just been wiped out and man's gone back to this primitive feral existence. At any rate, the monologue, the gloomy monologue, comes to an end, and he says, he introduces Max as this figure, as this man of the old world, who was broken and smashed by the general decay of society. And then he says, and it was here in this blighted place he learned to live again. And then the camera pans down as if you were on a helicopter, and if you go straight into the windscreen of Mad Max's car, and he's like screaming along on the with the let's go of the turbo, the main bombastic action music kicks in, and you've got like the weird degenerate bikers coming along behind them, and you just think, well, then that's how you introduce a movie. Like, that's a movie intro. Christ, you're up for it. You know what I mean? You just can't wait. Absolutely 10 out of 10 in my book, that intro.
Yeah, it is like the first movie. It's a really fun movie as well. And a great action movie, and also a lot of interesting themes to get into. So like this week was the first time I had ever seen it, but yeah, I definitely like how it transitions from the first one to the second one. I one thing that I think is really good about this trilogy is that there's a pretty big distinction between the three movies, and what I'd say really differentiates them is the stages of collapse of each of them, and also maybe Max's character arc. So it does pick up nicely where the first one left off. The first one started with him as a like I mentioned earlier, the good cop who's trying to hold on to what's left of civilization. It ends with him becoming the madman who is wandering the wasteland, and then it starts off with him as Mad Max. So yeah, definitely a great intro.
And one of the things you'll notice this, so there's the thing about the, especially the second movie and then the first one, the Beyond Thunderdome is a bit more Hollywood. I mean, because it did get picked up by the American studios, it had a bigger budget, but it was still very much a kind of an Australian independent affair. And the sheer rawness and kind of tragic aspect to the film is something else. There's this really like dark, poetic feel to it all, which I find it difficult to explain. You've got that adagio playing throughout. You've got these weird, the soundtrack is very Wagnerian, because each of the characters has their own like motif. so that when you see the say the gyro captain, he comes into it, even when he's just on the floor, he's got his own tune. Max has got his own tune. The settlers in the oil refinery have got their own tune. Lord Humongous has got his own. So, and it all mixes it up. And if you listen to Wagner, you'll notice that he does that. So each character, even if it's just a couple of bars, it's like signals that in that way you can express what your characters are actually thinking. So if your characters look up and they look worried, there'll be a couple of bars of the villain or something like that. And all of this is just wrapped up in this somber, brutal, raw masterpiece of a film. And it doesn't let up either. I mean, the gyro captain comes in quite early on, and there's a scene which is always horrified me, where what happens is they're trying to send the people in the encampment, the refinery, which is normal people. You'll notice as well they're all dressed in white. And they're trying to homestead. They're trying to make life decent for themselves. And then you've got the Lord Humongous and his dogs of war, and they are all like barbaric, degenerate filth. And they want what they have got. It's the standard kind of thing where what people talk about after the apocalypse. It's all very well saying you're going to be prepped, but you're going to have to protect your stuff from the predators that's out there. And they've literally like reverted to a sort of state of being like wolves or hyenas or something like that, just roaming around scavenging. The point on Lord Humongous is that there's I don't want to get too carried away in this, but it, just to bring it up, is that there's a take goes around that Lord Humongous is actually Fifi from the first movie, and they kind of get some nods and winks in about why that is. But what is more interesting is that if you look at all of the gang, they're all cops. Like they're all driving cop cars, and they're all dressed up as cops, like what the cops look like in the first movie. And it's as if in this topsy-turvy dystopia, the post-apocalypse, everything's been flipped on its head, and the cops are now like sort of descended into these kind of degenerate barbarians with, what do they call them, like assless chaps?
Yeah. and like I said earlier, in a collapse, I'd imagine that the cops would become a gang of their own, trying to vie for power. There definitely is like these homoerotic themes in the movie, but I don't think that that's like a criticism of the movie, because that's portrayed as they're the villains. So the good guys, the homesteaders, does their community have a name? I can't remember. What are they called? Or they just
they don't. But the main, like their chief is called Papagaya. So Papagaya's like people.
Yeah. So a Papagaya's people. His gang. Not really gang, but more like settlement. They're all really kind of wholesome people. They just want they even have like a kind of a prophecy, which we can get onto later. That you see that theme in both the second and the third film. What they're trying to do is trying to rebuild some semblance of civilization. They're trying to get reinstitute order and sanity into people's lives. And what you see with them is like they all seem to be really kind of decent, wholesome people. Whereas the gang who are trying to invade them, like they're the ones who are. Homosexuals, and degenerates, but also like extremely violent, and no civilization can come out of them. What they're really doing is they're kind of these marauders, terrorizing the wasteland, trying to scavenge whatever they can, whatever is left over from the times before the apocalypse. While the people in the settlement, they're trying to rebuild something new. So the end result of with this battle. So if the gang wins, then civilization is just going to further disappear into the back mirror. It's going to become a further distant memory, because the only thing they can really do is destroy. They're just trying to consume what's left of it. while if the settlement wins, then something greater is going to be built for the future. So I do think there is a very big contrast between good and evil here. They are both tribes, but there is a very, one of them is virtuous and one of them is not.
Yeah, yeah. And this is where the theme from the original, where sort of Max reaches his breaking point and he decides to give up on, say, human goodness. Which kind of happens, well, that happens for certain when his wife and child are murdered by Toe Cutter and his gang. And then it stays that way into for the rest of Mad Max 1, and then also for a sizable chunk of Mad Max 2. And this is what the monologue says, the intro says. It was here in this blighted place that he learned to live again. And what that means is that when Max meets the gyro captain, I'm going to do one more. Looks like gasoline, eh? Eh? I've been doing this stuff all my life, man. These looks like gasoline. So he kidnaps the gyro captain. And you can tell he's quite prepared to murder him. He doesn't care if he starves to death. And you've got that scene where Max is eating, they're looking on Papagaya's sort of refinery fortress. And Max is eating the tin of dog food. And then he gets what he wants. And then he gives it to his own dog. And then, like, the gyro captain has to, like, carefully take, like, the absolute last of the last slops and try from the dog. Like, that's he is after the dog. And Max doesn't care if he starves. He doesn't care if he dies or anything. He doesn't even unchain him from the log that he's got him shackled to. And what I'm getting at here is that Max is clearly, like, sort of hollowed out. He's not a very nice fella. And even when he goes, he rescues, because a couple of the settlers try to escape. They get captured. There's a horrible rape scene and murder. It's really quite raw. Like, and then Max finds one of their sons and takes him, you know, to drop him off back where in the refinery. But when you look at the dialogue, there's not much dialogue. I think Mel Gibson has like 20 lines in the whole movie. But it's just a transaction. Like, he's saying, here's your son. It's not my fault that he died. But I had a deal with him that if I saved him, you'd give me you'd give me all the gas that I wanted. Like, it seems that he's died, but that's not my fault. And it's purely a transaction. He doesn't care about them. And then he kind of falls in with them a little bit and he begins to melt, but he's still only in it for the gas. That's all he wanted. And of course it goes wrong for him because he fills up his car with all the gas that he can get. He tries to break through Lord Humongous's Dogs of War army and it goes wrong for him and he gets blown to pieces and he almost dies. Gyro Captain brings him back. So Max has lost his car. He's a complete state. And then it's like, well, I'll drive the rig. I'll help you out. The rig is an interesting one because you get that comes in the first scene, and you can see on the side of it. Obviously, the driver's been murdered and whatnot. But then on the side of the rig, it's got it's like painted. The vermin have inherited the earth. And there's the driver falls out and he drops he's dead. And out of his pocket is this little music box, and Max picks it up. And you can see like he's almost just like some creature from the wasteland himself. He is just like a coyote or something, and he starts to turn the music box. I can't remember what the tune's called, but
it was Happy Birthday, wasn't it?
Was it Happy Birthday? And and he looks at it like in a strange way and gives like a smile, as if this softness, this sort of civilization and humanity, like he'd completely forgotten what it was. Like this is something new and curious to him. This relic from the ancient world. Little touches like that. Just absolute brilliant stuff. And so then later, when he's back in the refinery, he says, I'm not gonna do another impression. Like, what was it you were gonna jump in with there?
Well, no, go ahead.
No, that was me done. That was me done on that little monologue bit.
Oh, okay, yeah. So about him, that at the beginning of the film, he picks up where he left off in the first film. So as we mentioned earlier, in the first film, it ends with him basically getting revenge on the biker gang and slaughtering them, and then, you know, going off into the wasteland, because what he was originally defending, that's gone now. And then we mentioned at the beginning of the movie, he basically he captures the gyro captain, and he basically uses him to get fuel, and he doesn't care if he dies. And then even when he gets back to the compound, it is self-interest as well, that he's trying to he just needs fuel for his car, and he doesn't really care much about the settlement. But I think that you know, he kind of does remember, he kind of does gain some of his goodness back, because yeah, he realizes that well, he needs to actually help these people, because first of all, I think that, you know, there's a good reason to help them, but also if he just wants to be one of these, like, kind of the lone wolf, well, there's a lot of problems with that, because just as soon as somebody gets the drop on you, well, then you lose everything, as we actually happens to him in the third movie as well. It's definitely better to have your tribe than to just kind of be the lone wolf. Now, unfortunately for Max, he doesn't actually end up with a tribe in either movie, but you definitely see it in the conclusion of each movie. Those who go off and start something new, who go off and create new civilizations, they're the ones who end up who I think would actually flourish in the wasteland. But, you know, Max kind of does regain some of his morality from the first movie. So he eventually does see that, yes, I do need to, it actually is a good idea to help these people. He might be in it for himself at the beginning, but eventually he starts to see that, yeah, there is something that here that there is some goodness still left in the world.
Yeah, and this is the one of the, I think probably the because it's not a movie, it's not a Quentin Tarantino movie where all of the characters just talk shite all of the time. Like, it's very sparse on dialogue. So when there is an actual sort of proper back and forth, it matters. And I think the one that's key here is the back and forth with Papagaya and Max. Because Papagaya is actually, he's actually telling Max, he's actually saying, like, he says to him, like, you belong out there with the trash. Like, we are trying to regain our humanity with dignity and live like real people. We're going to have families. We're going to have our own food, and we're going to live in a with morals. But you belong out there with the garbage. And he says, like, what was your problem, Max? Like, did you lose somebody? Did you maybe lose some family? And when he says that, Max smacks him in the mouth, because it's touched a raw nerve. And it's what Papa Guy is accusing him of is, like, wandering around the wasteland and just kind of wallowing in self-pity. And he says, like, we've all lost somebody. We've all been through it. But you're just going to wander the trash of the wasteland forever. And what this eventually spurs them on to do is where Max says, well, okay, I'm going to drive the rig and get you out of here, which leads to the big epic the sort of big chase scene, which became a kind of a cliche as the movies went on. In Mad Max 2, it was really the first time they did it, because you didn't really have anything like that at the first one. In the first one, he just, like, murdered, by proxy, the Johnny the Boy, the toe cutter, and there wasn't these big set pieces. So it comes in here for the first time. But you can see as well that in the end, they double-crossed him, because there wasn't actually any fuel in the tanker itself. They'd squirreled away, you know, and then the monologue that comes in as well. But the idea was that it wouldn't have mattered if Max had died. because it was a dupe. He was a decoy, because what really mattered was the people. It was the families. It was the future. And the what's left in the wasteland is like, that's irrelevant. They're leaving it. You can all kill each other, but we're gone. We're slipping away to the other, up to the paradise of the north.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I do love about the chase scene is that all the vehicles they're driving are kind of these like dune buggies. Is that what they're called? Like they're basically like a car, only a frame of a car. And all the modern cars from the first movie, which are cool in that setting, but all those are now gone. Now everyone's driving one of these like patched together contraptions, which it just makes for a really cool chase scene, I will say.
You'll notice as well that they're using like crossbows and bows and arrows, because and that makes perfect sense, because where would you get gunpowder from? Gunpowder is a bit like fuel in that it's this extremely rare commodity. Somebody pointed out in the chat, like Max never had any shells in his sawn-off shotgun that he was pointing in the gyro captain's face. It was all a ripoff.
Oh yeah, actually, I didn't notice that. That's true, because you see later in the movie that like part of his the bargain that he makes with the settlement is that they'll give him, I think it's only 2 shotgun shells, isn't it?
Yeah, and they don't work.
Yeah, so what you have now is that firearms are becoming a thing of the past, because you're not going to have any ammunition for them, and if nobody's producing that, as soon as it's used up, it's gone. Which is something I really like, because I've always thought about that in a lot of post-apocalyptic movies, that like you'd run out of gunpowder, you'd run out of ammunition really quickly, because nobody's going to be producing it anymore. Same with the firearms themselves. And what I like about this one is that now these are kind of like this really sought after item, something that's extremely rare and valuable now, because there's not so many of them left, and once they're gone, they're gone. So about like the conclusion of the film, where the settlement, they go off to kind of the promised land of the north, and they go off to build a new civilization. Max kind of, I do like the part where in the monologue, so the monologue is from the perspective of the wild child, the kind of the boy that like is savage.
The feral kid with the razor boomerang.
Yeah, I love that scene where he sneaks out of the tunnel and then throws the boomerang, and it like slots off that one guy's hand, and then he hits the other guy and like takes off the other guy's head. I thought that was so cool.
It's like it just kills Wes's boyfriend on the it just slams straight into his forehead, and the way that it's filmed as well, it's like it's like this really quick thud to the floor. Like nobody would fall that fast, but it's like everything else, it's savage, and everybody bursts out laughing when it takes off that fella's. He's kind of like the master of ceremonies. And he introduces Lord Humongous as the Ayatollah of rock and roller, you know, the master of the waste and all of this kind of thing. I mean, the general sort of thing with the bikers is kind of a little bit dated, but I was thinking, like, if this happened, because they are degenerate and they are weird, you can say they are tough. They are tough, there's that thing. But what I'm leading to is, like, if there was like this apocalypse, would this be what like shitlibs became, like lefties? Or do you think they'd just die? Because there's a tendency to look at them and think, well, you know, you can do that kind of Nietzschean, they are like, They've overcome it, you know, the might makes right and all of this kind of thing. But you can also say that actually they're just completely and utterly degenerate. They're not going to have any families. In long term, it belongs to the settlers in the refinery. And this is kind of what Papagaya's fault is. And I just think there's a lot of them in this kind of way they are, which reminds me of like Antifa or something. But yeah, I have to be careful there, because there is a lot of iron crosses and like German symbolism in their stuff as well. But with that caveat aside, just to just to drop it into the conversation, you know.
But yeah, I tend to think that they do represent, they do resemble something like Antifa a lot more as well. Now, I do think if there was an actual collapse, I don't think shitlibs would be go. I think they would all just disappear really quickly. But in the context of where they live and where we live today, in the kind of a society of the Mad Max universe versus our the real world today, they do kind of serve a similar purpose. You know, they're just a force for destruction, which is basically just leeching off of a dead society. Like, they have no future, just like the shitlibs in Western society have no future, right, either. What they're doing is they're leeching off of everything that's left, kind of scavenging the remnants for all it's worth, and then just disappearing into the nothingness, and then leaving nothing behind but destruction. I kind of think that that's really the role that they serve. Do you want us to get into like real world comparisons right now, or do you want to save that for later?
Drop one in then if there's one.
Well, there, yeah, I mean, what I was going to say is that you see with with the shitlibs today, like they don't have a future. There won't be people like Antifa or people like I'm just trying to think of a famous shitlib off the top of my head. What is his name? Owen Jones, is he still a thing? There won't be people like that in 20, 30 years. What there's going to be, if we're going to look at the trajectory of the West, there won't be anti-white whites anymore. They're just going to die off, and then all that you're going to have left is huge swarms of diversity, as we as it's termed these days, and the whites, which are resilient enough and ethnocentric enough to actually band together and create something that a means of actually surviving, if that happens, which I think it will. But the bikers, they're something that won't exist into the future. They're only a force of destruction, that the only potential they really have is to destroy what could come in the future. So they only have the potential to destroy, to prevent the rebirth of civilization. They do not have the ability to create something new, because, I mean, one thing you mentioned is, like, most of them are homosexuals or bisexuals, since they even rape women as well. But they're obviously not going to reproduce. They aren't building anything of value. They seem to be, I think that they're nomadic in that they just drive around stealing from people, aren't they? They don't actually have like
a base. Yeah, I mean, I was gonna touch on that. So obviously, like, the MacGuffin of Mad Max 2 is fuel, gasoline. And when I was younger, I used to, because I've always loved these films. Well, I did wonder, now it is a strange thing. Like, if you were in that situation, like, would you really be like obsessed with having a tank full of fuel for your car? Like, I don't get it. Why does everything have to center on the roads? Because it is Australia, and the roads would be tiny. You could just it seemed to me that you could just disappear into the outback. But it actually kind of makes sense, because there's nothing, if you're a creature that has to scavenge, you have to cover massive amounts of distance to actually get what you want, to actually sustain yourself, because there's just nothing. So you've got to always be on the move. And in that way, so from that perspective, like, having the mobility of a car, let's say, to get you around, to find new things to sustain yourself, would actually be, like, it does make sense. It would become absolutely crucial. And rather than, like, people disappearing into the wasteland, which is kind of like what the people in the refinery want to do in a way, and it's something which will pop up again in Beyond Thunderdome with the kids. But you can see, at least in Mad Max 2, that actually everything is centered on the roads, because that's how people get around. And so it's weird in a way that all life will be centered on this way of networking, this way of getting from point A to point B efficiently, which is the roads. And then the roads themselves become like the most dangerous place, because that's where everything's happening. That's where things are going to be transported. So there is a logic to it. It does make sense.
And I also was wondering that if the gang actually successfully took over the oil well, because the settlement has an oil well, and that like their real claim to power is that they're able to not only do they have a lot of oil, they're able to actually produce oil, which is something that in this world is invaluable. Because everyone is just what you see with Max is that at the beginning of the second movie, he comes across rig, that big truck, which was broken down and the driver was murdered. And he just basically checks to see if they have any oil or fuel. And then he kidnaps the gyro captain to take the fuel from him. So we have this settlement that's built around this oil well where they're able to actually produce this not just scavenge it. If the gang took that over, I'm pretty sure that would not stay in operation. You'd have them all killing each other eventually over it, and I don't think that they would actually be able to maintain that for very long. It only works because the people that are doing it are virtuous.
And the only reason that the gang is in any way cohesive is because Lord Humongous is literally humongous. Like, he's built like a brick shithouse. So there's nobody who can physically take him on or dominate him. So that's it. It's as simple and barbaric and ancient as that. He is the sovereign because he's big and he's tough. Like, they've gone all the way. I mean, don't get me wrong, leaving aside, like, you know, the comparisons to Antifa, like, there's a lot of people would be kind of like thinking, yeah, if only politics was that simple, where you just had this big fella with muscles, he laid down the law, and then that was it. And you didn't have all the lies and the trickery of like the modern political. I know there's people on Twitter or not, whether they'll write threads on like, we need a leader like Lord Humongous. Lord Humongous did nothing wrong and all of this kind of thing, you know.
Well, I certainly don't endorse that, but I mean, when you do see who does rule over us today, like Zuckerberg or Gates or whoever it is, like, I mean, you do wonder if there was like some, you know, some guy there to just like
vote Lord Humongous.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I can't say that I can't say that he would alleviate us from the LGBT agenda. So, I mean, he's not based in that way. So,
so sort of the what the mythological thing returns at the very end of the movie. And this is kind of strange because it's kind of disorientating, but it makes more sense if you just think of this like a kind of like, you know, the Clint Eastwood movies we did where you don't know if he's a ghost or not. It's a similar kind of thing because then the gyro captain leads them all to the far north where presumably they'll be safe. And then the feral kid in the fullness of time, he becomes the leader of the tribe and he's speaking as a very old man, as we got from the start. You're looking at maybe 60 years in the future when the feral kids your Mad Max 2 is the timeline's got, so the feral kids end monologue is set maybe 60 years after Mad Max 2, and what he says of course is he tells what happens, and then the striking music comes in and he says, "For the road warrior, that's the last we ever saw of him." And then the camera pans in, you see Max all battered and bruised with all of his war scars, and he's just standing in the middle of the road. And then it closes. So the idea is that like Max is kind of doomed forever to wander alone in the wasteland forever and ever. But not quite alone, because then that takes us to Beyond Thunderdome, which pretty much everybody will say will be the weakest of the original three. And yes, I'm going to touch on Fury Road in a bit as well. Beyond Thunderdome straight away. Beyond Thunderdome is much more Hollywood than the first two. You can get that. We got Tina Turner doing a power ballad, belting it out. It looks more glossy. You get just straight away. There's much more of a Hollywood feel to it. And in this particular case, we open, and this is where they've undone the law, because the gyro captain, at the time of Beyond Thunderdome, the gyro captain should have been with the Papagayas people up north. But what they've actually done is kind of, they've given him a different name, but you never really knew the gyro captain's name.
Was it the same guy though?
That's the thing. He's got a different name. I should have looked it up. He's got a different name, but by the time he robs Max at the start of it, and he's got his little aeroplane with his kid on. So the assumption is we're now about, say, 7 or 8 years or 10 years after Mad Max 2, and it's not really made clear whether it's actually the gyro captain or somebody else. But it's the same actor and everything. But the problem is, he's supposed to be up north now with the people from the first one.
I thought the same thing. I was a bit confused by that, because it did say in the last one that he went up north and became the leader of their new settlement that they created. So, I mean, I just thought, for continuity and for the lore, it must have been a different person, even though. Was it actually the same actor?
It's Bruce Spence. He is also in the Lord of the Rings extended editions. He's the mouth of Sauron, who Aragorn chops his head off.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, I do think maybe that is kind of a criticism of the film I'd have, is they really should have just kind of made it clear he wasn't the same guy. I guess for my own purposes, I'd say he is a different guy, because that kind of makes the to make the lore a bit more coherent.
There's a bigger problem. They're setting a bigger problem for that, because and that relates to Fury Road, because now they've kind of disrupted the continuity, which was definitely there. And in the first two movies, it's like one big movie. But then when you get to Beyond Thunderdome, they've reintroduced the gyro captain, basically, who shouldn't be there. Because they've done that, then it means it's set the precedent. So then when it comes to Fury Road, and I had loads of people on Twitter telling us this week, was that, well, there is no continuity. Just look at the gyro captain. It isn't one long saga. It's more like just sort of make it up as you go along, and after they have done this with the gyro captain, it kind of is like that. So what that allows for is, I mean, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but in Fury Road, everything is just thrown out, but there's reasons for that, which I'll get into briefly here, and then we can go back to Beyond Thunderdome. If you look at Fury Road, it's clearly meant if you look at it from the perspective that the script was written for Max or Mel Gibson as being in his, this is where we get to some controversial stuff because we're talking, it's the first time we've actually properly kind of focused on based Mel, isn't it?
Yeah, I was going to say, actually, he is probably the most based guy in Hollywood.
So let's go back. The year is 2013-ish, 2014. The production gets rolling. Hollywood, certain people in Hollywood, a lot of big players in Hollywood, they want to have a new Mad Max movie because it's a good money spinner, but they don't want Mel Gibson in it for reasons which I'm sure people, this is my view on this. So what's happened is they've recast. So the script of Fury Road is clearly designed. It makes sense if you think that Max would be the same age as Immortan Joe. Immortan Joe, by the way, is played by the same actor as the toe cutter in the first movie. So if Max was well into his 50s, the same round about the same age as Morton Joe, it all makes sense, because then you're looking at, say, 30 years after the end of the world, and a lot of things kind of slot into place. But Tom Hardy was only 35, so it doesn't make really much sense. But they can get away, they can explain that away by saying, well, there's no continuity with the Mad Max movies. It doesn't make any difference because of what happened with the Gyro Captain in Beyond Thunderdome. So yeah, that's me sort of take on that.
Yeah, and that is unfortunate because, you know, because first reason, I liked the conclusion of the second movie a lot. But then secondly, I feel like if the character wasn't the Gyro Captain, then it would play better into the third movie as well. So I like to think of them that they're just not the same person. But if it's
in Fury Road, they even give him his car back. So, which was obviously blown to pieces and wrecked, gone in Mad Max 2. But there you go. They're just...
Yeah. So, anyway, like, getting into the third movie. So, it starts off with the guy flying the plane, whoever he is, stealing the camels. And then, because now it's, what, 10 years after the apocalypse? So... cars are almost a thing of the past now, and Max is now riding around on a carriage full of camels, and he gets ambushed, and his carriage gets stolen, and it's taken to this place, Barter Town, where somebody sells them for whatever, and now Max has to go to Barter Town to try to win back his camels. And I mean, we can get into the differences between Barter Town and the gangs and the first one and then the settlement. Because when we compare, and also the kids from later in the movie, with Barter Town, it is kind of a semblance of civilization in that they actually do have laws, that they actually do have rules there. But at the same time, it's, again, I don't think it's one that could advance beyond their current state. And I think it's the same reason as with the gangs in the first and second movie, is that, well, I mean, they're just not virtuous people. Barter Town, while it does have its own kind of set of laws and stuff, it really is kind of run on this cutthroat, self-interested individualism, where everybody is out to enrich themselves as much as possible. And there isn't really kind of that virtue, which you see in with the settlement in the previous movie, and then you'll see later with the kids at the end of this movie. So I do think that with Barter Town, they're able to kind of rebuild something, but it's never going to get very, I wouldn't imagine that actually getting very far beyond the kind of primitive civilization that they had created.
Yeah, the general arc, you can see that. So we've now moved from just scavenging to Tina Turner taking the next step to kind of organize something of a basic economy, which is that, well, you can trade, you can swap the goods that you've stolen from other people. But you can see they've brought in laws against this kind of thing, and that's where Master Blaster and the Dome comes into it, because justice will be where you go in and you duke it out in the Thunderdome. And I mean, there's a bit of a power. There's an interesting dynamic with, basically, they don't even have fuel anymore by this point. So they're using pig crap as turn it into methane and then using that to power everything. But the little old man, he rides around on this giant sort of, I don't know, I'm on YouTube, but he, what would you call them? What's a politically correct word for, like, somebody who's slow? What are we allowed to say now? I don't know. But he's not all there. He's basically got the mentality of a five-year-old, but he's about 7'5" or whatever. And they are able to blackmail and harass and bully Tina Turner because they can switch off the power whenever they want. And so this sets in play where Max comes in off the wasteland, and he gets embroiled into sort of doing the bidding of Tina Turner to do a hit job on Master Blaster, right?
Yeah, so his way of getting back his camels and his property is that she kind of tries to get him to have a fight with Blaster. So Master Blaster is actually two guys. Master's this really short guy who rides on Blaster's back. So Master is like an extremely intelligent guy who's really small, while Blaster's this extremely stupid guy, but who's like 7 feet tall. I can't remember the exact details of how it goes down, but basically Max breaks the deal. And then he's exiled. So, he doesn't actually finish off Blaster. He defeats him in the fight, but he doesn't actually kill him. So like the idea of the Thunderdome, the chant they have, two men enter, one man leaves. So it's like, it's fight to the death. And, he actually doesn't kill him, but then, what's her name? The woman that runs Bartertown. Tina Turner.
In the movie, she's called Aunt May, but Tina Turner's good enough.
Tina Turner, yeah. So one of her goons basically finishes him off, and then is that what? That's why Max is cast out of Bartertown, because he didn't go through with the deal. Is that correct?
Yeah, because it was one man enter, two man enter, one man leave, and he refused.
So yeah, he refused to kill Blaster.
So then they had to do it for him, and then they frame Max basically, because it's also a way of getting, because he's in on the dirty deal as well. So it's a way for them to get rid of him as well.
Yeah. So then he's cast out of Bartertown, and they basically just put him on a horse, put some big like clown head mask thingy on him, and then just send him off into the desert to die. And then he's picked up by this this kind of tribe of children. So children, teenagers, like the, I think that the oldest ones would, I put them at what, 15 maybe? 16?
Yeah.
Do they explain exactly where they came from?
Well, they don't know. So if we pick up what's happened here, because this is why I will defend Beyond Thunderdome a little bit, because it's true that it's a lot softer and a lot more mainstream, and
the violence is way toned down. I noticed that, like, there's no, like, the scenes in the first one of people like getting exploded and blown up.
And I get the criticisms, you know, we talk about the gyro captain and stuff, but I will defend it a bit, and here's why. We've started on the first movie where it was the precipice, you know, it was just before the fall. We then, in Mad Max 2, we're in it. We're in the worst possible scenario. Civilization has completely collapsed. And so Beyond Thunderdome, the general idea and the general themes of it are that things are beginning, like we've got the first little shoots of spring coming back up. And this is why there's such a heavy emphasis on the children, because the children are the future. But what that's juxtaposed with, strangely enough, when you consider the second movie, is that this time it's the settlement which is the poison. And it's the people, it's the nomads who are out there in the outback, who are the future. They are the good ones. And it's Tina Turner's Rotten Town, which is like Max sees it as being a failure. And so the children themselves, what they allude to this, and it's weird because they've got their own, the two have created their own origin story. So again, it doesn't really make much sense, because some of the kids are really young, like literally like 3 or 4 years old, whereas the older one, I don't know what the lad's called, like the muscly lad, but I know what the girl's called. She's called Savannah. I know that because I fancied her when I was a kid. So they are the oldest ones there in their teens, 16, 17. And so what happened is that there's an aeroplane crashed in the desert, which seems strange, but all of the kids survived and the adults didn't. Or some of the adults did, and they went wandering back off into the wasteland to get help. And they found this little piece of paradise here where they stashed the children while they went off. Now, obviously, it being the world of Mad Max, we can presume that all of their parents and the survivors were wiped out by, say, Lord Humongous. But the aeroplane is still there, and they are waiting for the captain. I forgot the name. But basically, the airline. Captain Walker will arrive one day and take them away. So when Mad Max arrives, they think he's Captain Walker. They think he is there to save them and show them the way and all of this, which obviously he isn't. But they've also, like, they talk strange as well, which is a nice touch because they haven't had they've never known civilization. But the I think the general idea that he's going for here is that the future has arrived now. But that there's some issues when you get further towards the end of the movie with it, because I mean, I may as well just say it now. They go on an adventure. They go back to Bartertown and they kind of wreck the place. Tina Turner spies Max. She thinks of Max as being something of a kindred spirit because they're both from the old world. But what eventually happens is that the gyro captain flies them away and flies them into, I think it's Sydney. And of course, it's all of the skyscrapers are falling apart. It's just a big dump. It looks a mess. It's a horrible apocalyptic wasteland. And I just think in terms of story and plotting, that's such a stupid thing to do because it runs against the entire kind of grain of what they're trying to say here. Because Savannah, what they want to do the thing that the feral kid does at the end of the second movie, and it's like, once again, the Max saves the innocents through not so much his own barbarism, but in this one, it's like because he's quick. He's quick-witted. And it's like Max saves the innocents again, but he himself is still left out on the wasteland, wandering around, as he always has been. That's the whole what they're going for there. And they're inside these wrecked buildings, which have been destroyed by a nuclear blast. The nuclear element is also in this much more. You see people with Geiger counters and things like measuring the radiation. So all of these new elements are there more to appease a Hollywood audience, in my view. And another thing they have done to appease a Hollywood audience is to give you that vista of the old world, which is completely destroyed, which in a way is fair enough. But what I find like kind of stupid is that they've then had the children go back to live in like these hollowed out husks of the cities when they had like this paradise, like a literal oasis of fresh water where they were safe. And so, but what they want is to have this thing where, and Savannah says, well, those out there, we will keep the lights on because we know they'll come home one day. And I think, well, come home to what? This is running against the idea of a fresh start. What you're doing is crawling back into the wreckage of the old world in a way that Lord Humongous's gang would have done. I mean, even Tina Turner understood this. Even Tina Turner was like, in the old world, I was not a nobody, now I'm a somebody. Because she's built the town, because she realizes there's no turning back. And the dynamic between her and Max is that they're kind of kindred spirits because they're both people who are broken by the old world, but they're still there clinging on to what's dear to them. In her case, it's building a town, which she regards as the beginning of a new civilization, which it isn't. It's a dump, which Max recognizes. And in Max's case, it's defending the innocents. And that's why it makes sense when she captures him at the end and she says, like, so long, Raggedy Man, and she lets him go because she understands they're both kindred spirits, which is, it's a nice touch. I quite like that. But the idea of putting what your kind of signifier of the future back in an apocalyptic city just because you want to sell like that vista to a Hollywood audience is kind of stupid. I don't like that at all.
Yeah, like, you know, there were elements that I really liked. You know, I did find the kids really heartwarming, really. I thought that it was kind of wholesome. I liked that the kids had no knowledge of, the only knowledge they had of civilization. So they had no experience of the world before the collapse. They were children who were born after the collapse, which I think that's kind of if the flight was how they got there, the plane crashing, I think that's kind of a problem, because would there even be planes flying in the air at the time? Probably not. That is kind of a criticism against the movie. But one thing I really do like is that the kids, their knowledge of the old world is through folklore. That they have like these stories which they told, like they have this prophecy of Captain Walker someday coming back and flying them to the Forever Everland, as they call it, which is the what they think of as civilization is. But I do like the scenes of Max going back to Barter Town and bringing the one prisoner guy and master with them, and then them flying off with the not gyro captain, whoever the character is supposed to be. But I have to agree that I don't like the conclusion that what they do is they go back to the old deceased civilization, because I really like the idea of a new start. So like the second one ended with them going off to the northern lands to start anew. I would have liked something with the children, you know, starting anew in like that oasis that they had. I like that kind of theme a lot better, because it prophesizes something that's a lot more forward looking, and that it's kind of accepting that the old civilization is gone now and we have to move on to something new. I didn't like the end that their idea is going back to what was and not what going into something in the future.
That's not their world. That is the world of Tina Turner and Mad Max. Like so the way that I'll rewrite the script for Hollywood. What they should have had at the end, if you notice as well, when they're in that wrecked building, Savannah's pregnant. So again, you've got that theme again. It's like this is the future. It's a few years later, I think, and she's pregnant, presumably with Chad there, the other hunter. And what they could have done was go back to the oasis, but they would have had the oasis would have been a little bit more refined, and it would have been this kind of back to Eden, perfect place to be, because the theme here is innocence. They're innocent about what happened to the world. They're innocent about what the world is like at Tina Turner's Barter Town. It's like this pure, almost like a blank slate, where this is fresh. These are new, innocent, like fresh shoots coming through the ground. So when Savannah's pregnant at the end, they could have had them back at the oasis, living a perfect life. We're developing their own folklore, you know, which would eventually give them a culture. And then you could have, if you wanted to have the vista of the wrecked Sydney, then they could have had Max there. They could have had Max wandering through the destroyed world. And that's consistent, because that's Max's problem, is that he is weighed down, like in all of the movies. He's weighed down by the past, by losing his family. He's traumatized. He's been through God knows what. And yet, even at the end of the third movie, even when there's a new civilization just blossoming, you know, the shoots are just popping up like spring, still Max is left in winter, a literal nuclear apocalypse, the nuclear winter, and he's there alone, wandering through the wreckage of the old world still. But Savannah could say they'll come home eventually, you know, meaning they'll come with the tribe, which I don't know, that opens up sort of other problems, because it's you don't want their innocence being sort of defiled by the old world, especially because, like, Tina Turner, it's implied that she was just like some sleazy prostitute or like a nightclub singer or something like that. Everybody's been broken, you know, everybody's just weighed down with all this baggage of the old world, and this is the new world is coming into being. There's no way that they should have been in the city, but it's kind of a minor point to spend 10 minutes on, but yeah. It is kind of irritating that they did that.
It could have been, yeah, that part could have been done better. Cause I even did like the prophecy of like the children dreaming of flying, that like the captain would fly them out of there. Then eventually the guy at the end does actually fly them. I thought that was actually kind of nice, but you know, so I didn't like, sorry.
Yeah. Finish your point there.
Well, yeah, but I didn't like that. The idea was that he's going to fly them back to the city.
So. Yeah. I mean, somebody in the chat raises an interesting point where they say if they'd stayed in the Oasis, they would never have grown up. Well, the problem is that I think the point is that it's as if the old world is just toxic and you don't want to be touched by it. What we're talking about is like the beginning of an entirely new civilization from the absolute sort of ground zero. I would have them stay innocent for forever. There is the problem that they get discovered. You know, there is the problem, that lack of scruples, that lack of worldliness. It is a hazard. But so, Max's point is deliberately to keep them shielded from Barter Town as long as possible. In fact, I mean, he even punches Savannah in the face to try and stop them leaving, because he knows what's in store for them, and he's right as well.
Yeah, and the point is, I guess the guy was making is that if somebody, say like the gangs from the first movie, if they the first and the second movie, if they invaded, they just have no defense against them whatsoever.
Yeah. I mean, another problem with the bad guys, like Tina Turner's squad, they're just nowhere near as intimidating as either Toecutter's gang or Lord Humongous. Well, especially, you just get the impression that if Lord Humongous was to come across Tina Turner's gang, they would just tear them apart. Like, they would just own that town in no time flat. There's this big scene, like, you know, I mentioned earlier where on Mad Max 2 you get the big set piece with the rig and they're all along the road at the end, and they just copy it. Like, it's almost like it's been copy and pasted, but this time they're on a train. Except for that, it's all the same thing. You know, they're doing all of the gymnastics from car to car. But there's one like sort of chief goon, and he just like refuses. He goes through all kinds of things happen to him. And then he pops up like with a silly expression on his face, and it's like, whoa. And you just think, you know, if that was in Mad Max 2, like you would have been beheaded. and it irritates us because they come across as soft and not as scary and not as tough. And yet they've still got the assless chaps on, or he does at least.
Yeah. I mean, and the other thing, I mean, it's worth pointing out that with the casting of Tina Turner, apparently Australia got diversity after the apocalypse.
Yeah. I mean, that's Hollywood. That's Hollywood.
Yeah, I know.
Especially because at that time, it was standard practice where you would, when you launched, because by the time we get to Beyond Thunderdome, it was billed as being like a summer blockbuster in the way the other two movies just weren't. And what came along with that was like the thing where you have like a power ballad, and this one was "We Don't Need Another Hero," which to be fair, as power ballads go, it's not so bad. But it's not a bad song. But it seems like they just kind of put her in there as well, and you know, and then you've got the feminist thing as well. I kind of think that Tina Turner, she does. Like, she's obviously nowhere near as intimidating as Lord Humongous, but I can kind of see that she's got that kind of ice queen sort of thing. Like, you know, she's loud and kind of aggressive. So yeah, well, whatever. Like, I mean, in Fury Road, it's like Charlize Theron takes the main role, and that when you're talking feminism, then you really open up a can of worms.
Well, yeah, I haven't seen the third movie, so you're going to have to take that one, because I actually don't. Well, but I have heard that there's criticisms of it for this.
Well, reason. Okay, so leaving aside, I mean, I think we've done a decent enough job, because it is a lot to cover on one stream. Uh-huh. But what I wanted to get across, especially, was like the main arc of like mm-hmm. renewal in Beyond Thunderdome, which is why I would defend it a bit. But in Fury Road. It's. I mean, again, it's a lot to embark on. I didn't want to get. I don't want to get into it too much, but I will say. I mean, look, let's not be too harsh on it. Visually, and the stunts and everything are absolutely spectacular. It's not a bad movie. I'm not gonna like dump on the movie. I think it's a good film. It's definitely a good film to be made in. I think it was 2015, compared to like the stuff we get now. So I'm. What I dislike about it is that it's sort of as a Mad Max movie, like how it further disrupts the law, if you like. But basically, then you've got Toe Cutter comes back, but he's a Morton Joe now. And he's got this on the wasteland that you get, there's different clans, and there's all kinds of weird things going on with like a religion and things. But then they've each of the clans has got like their own thing that they produce. So one of them be like the bullet farm, and that's where all the bullets are made. And maybe another one will be like where cars are made, and the Morton Joe, he's got the water supply. And he rules like a feudal king. But what word gets a little bit more, what people are alluding to is that he's got, it's a bit rough, like, but he's got five or six like morbidly obese women that he uses just as breeders, and they're being milked all of the time as well. And I mean, and what they do is just give birth to his offspring, and a lot of them are like, one of them's a dwarf, one of them's like gigantic but dopey, and he's got these other ones, these prize ones, and they're prize women. And they're really young and really sexy. And Charlize Theron is one of his drivers. She's like his best rig driver, and she steals the girls in order to take them away back once again to the mythological promised land. I'll come back to that in a moment. So then of course Max gets sort of roped into it. He's imprisoned. He's doing the bit which you saw him in the, with, you know, like strapped to the front of the car and just driven around. He gets that treatment. He ends up going along for the ride and decides to help them out a little bit. It's Tom Hardy, though. And eventually they get to the promised land. This is where there's a twist. And there's three or four women. They've been there forever. And they once set out to, like, create another haven. But they've completely wrecked it. They completely ruined it, and there's nothing there. And Charlize Theron can't understand why, like, what happened. Like, how is it that a Morton Joe can have, like, it may be feudal, it may be barbaric, but at least it's something, like, functioning. What do they say in The Big Lebowski? Like, at least it's an ethos. But, yeah, so it turns out women can't actually create civilizations after all. That's kind of the get out on the feminist issue with it. But basically, yeah, so there's a bit, lots of car chases, and they all go back towards the Morton Joe's city. And in the end, Charlize Theron and like the women take over. One or two of them get killed along the way. And then, of course, which is now the standard, Max, after doing all of the heavy work, basically wanders off into the crowd, as is the thing, back out into the wasteland. It's enjoyable to watch. It just seems a shame to kind of what they've done with them. Like, as I was saying earlier, if they had Mel Gibson in there, it would have made a bit more sense, because he would have been well into his 50s and it would have been the same age as Morton Joe. And you could have had more of that thing about like the old world, you know, the before times and whatnot. But as it stands, it's just sort of completely incomprehensible when that actually fits into the lore. So this gives like what Red Letter Media said on their review, where it doesn't matter. You don't have to think about that, those things with Mad Max. But yeah, I don't really.
I kind of wish you did, though. I wish you kind of did have this lore, but oh well. I mean, I don't like the argument that, well, it's just an action movie, therefore the lore doesn't matter. You know, I've never liked that argument. But I guess what we could finish with is, like, how accurate do you think this would be, like, in an actual clap situation? Do you think it would look something like Mad Max?
I think it would be, if anything, it would be, like, more like Mad Max 2. I mean, it's like I said at the start of the stream, it seems like we've already passed like Mad Max 1. I think things are worse in our reality now than what they are in Mad Max 1.
Materially, I don't think quite, but like as in like actually, and as in which one would be worse to live in, I think definitely is true about.
I would rather live in Mad Max 1 than in London. I'm serious. I would rather live in Mad Max 1 than live in current day London. Like the goose goes out for a drink and takes the singer home. There's people going on holidays and having ice cream and everything. It's not that bad at all.
Yeah, I think though the difference is that this one is actually like a society that is collapsing, and that the system's no longer going to be able to sustain itself. The world that we're in right now, it's not that this, now, you know, this is a broader argument, but the system is not like going to collapse tomorrow. The problem is that living within this system is worse than living in a collapsing version of a system from 50 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things we should point out, because surprisingly, we've actually spent almost the entire stream on the films themselves and didn't really go out on a tangent. But, One of the things are when you like dystopia is all of the rage these days, and the Mad Max style of dystopia that fell out of fashion after the end of the Cold War, because when you got into the 90s, the 2000s, it didn't really sort of seem realistic anymore that civilization would have like what you could say was a hard crash. Like a hard actual like reset, not a great one, and where everything goes, and you're back on the land eating dog food and all of this, that kind of dystopia really became unfashionable after the sort of once you get into the 90s, because the nuclear war didn't seem to be as much of a threat anymore. Instead, the general sort of dystopias that you got was that the Mad Max style became unfashionable. And I think the most popular one would be where the sort of RoboCop, Blade Runner sort of tech dystopia, usually where corporations had taken over everything. And then people were sort of eating processed meats.
Or like Total Recall, the one we watched.
Total Recall would be another one. I mean, The Terminator is another example of like the sort of the hard crash, like the actual, you know, an extinction apocalypse event of nukes raining down on everybody, that seemed to sort of lose its edge as well. And so it tended to, I think the ones that became more popular were ones which depicted more of like this kind of tech driven dystopia over the, because if you look, I mean, you know, Blade Runner, say, in Mad Max, they're both dystopias, but they couldn't be more different. And because one of them is where there's too many people, there's too, like, everybody's, it's all overcrowded, but all of the lights are still on, people can still eat. And really what you get in with that kind of dystopia is more of a commentary on politics, or, you know, what separates us from artificial intelligence or replicants in the case of Blade Runner and this kind of thing. Whereas the question posed by Mad Max, is that how do you survive? What would it be like in a hard crash? And because throughout the 90s, 2000s, we had this time of abundance with no longer these kinds of existential threats, that particular brand of dystopia fell out of fashion, but it could be that it's coming back now.
I mean, would you even define Mad Max as a dystopian film? Because I do know, like, all the descriptions online do list it as dystopian. But I did have to think about that a bit, because when I think dystopia, I think of, like, some kind of system, that dystopias are, like, ideological in some way, that it's a system, a man-made system, or maybe perhaps an artificial intelligence system, but it's a system of some kind which basically makes life hell. Whereas in Mad Max, it's more like that the system, which I don't think it implies that the world that they lived in before the collapse was dystopian. It was kind of just modern society as it would have been in the 70s or 80s, and it fell apart. It just kind of seems like it's anarchy. It's the lack of a system. So I don't know I don't know if I can consider it fully like in the same genre as, say, a movie like Soylent Green, which we watched, which this one is a movie about like how a system becoming a dystopia, becoming like a hell on earth. Whereas Mad Max is more like a system falling apart, and what you're left with is just like is just anarchy. There is no system. Yeah, that's the point. There is no system at all. So just left with.
You could quibble. The official definition of dystopia here on Google says an imagined state or society in which there is great suffering or injustice, typically one that is totalitarian or post-apocalyptic. Environmental disaster is the backdrop to this modern dystopia. Interesting that they have that even on the official sort of definition of a dystopia. They have managed to slip in environmental disaster. Why not nuclear war?
Yeah, well, we all know the answer to that. I mean, the other thing I thought of is like I do like that, because oftentimes I entertain myself on the internet by checking up on what leftist anarchists are doing, just because it's like the most retarded, like, oh shit, sorry, it's just the most it's just the stupidest kind of theory cell nonsense on the internet you'll read. Like, you'll see these like huge blocks of text explaining how in their anarchist dystopia everyone is going to is going to work together, and there's going to be no private property. I did like that in Mad Max, like, and anarchy is just, it's absolute hell. It's just complete violence, degeneracy, lawlessness, and nothing can really actually come out of it. Go ahead.
I was just going to chime in that, like, Mad Max 2 is a pretty good critique of libertarianism.
Yeah, yes, exactly. So, like a libertarian society, an anarcho-capitalist, anarcho-communism, that's just never going to happen. Like, the idea that people could ever like organize civil society under those conditions is just delusional. But even like in terms of things like anarcho-capitalism, the problem with that is that there would be no way of defending your wealth. So you say like you have like there's no state, and it's everything is private, privately owned, and good luck, unless you have your own private military to defend your resources. You're not going to be able to, the industry is not going to exist. And you'd end up spending all of your resources defending it. So like you take a look at the second Mad Max movie, the settlement, which has just this one oil well, where they're able to get a bare minimum of resources, just enough to build the most primitive of civil societies. They have to defend that brutally. They have to have a constant barricade around that. It has to be armed to the teeth with flamethrowers, crossbows, everything around that, just to stop people from breaking in and stealing their resources. So like, you know, this idea that in under anarchy you'd have like this this kind of Randian society where everybody's like everything's privately owned and there's no state. It's just delusional. Like people would be not trying to produce anything. There'd be no industry. Everyone would just be scrambling to take what is available from others.
Well, I'll tell you how a sort of criticism of Lord Humongous's leadership. I mean, and how I think it would go is that Lord Humongous would say to Papagaya, for example, that, well, I will protect you from other gangs, but I want to cut. You've got to make sure that we've got enough petrol to enough gas in all of our vehicles. And we're going to take a cut of your food as well. But other than that, we're going to more or less leave you in peace. And then what he's creating there is like a vassal, like a client. So see, he would be sovereign, and then he has these client groups who come to depend on him. And there's probably other people out there somewhere, and he could do the same as that. So what you get is like the beginnings of a kind of kingship, a king of the wasteland. That's what he. But instead, all he wanted to do was like pillage and take everything, and it all went to hell for him in the end. And like that particular spot of the wasteland was completely, you know, just full of death.
I mean, that is how a lot of forces throughout history have expanded their power. It's by basically taking the lands that you conquer, you turn them into client states. Think of the Muslim Jihad, think of Genghis Khan. It's kind of like taking over these lands and then kind of putting them under your rule, that they have to pay tribute to you, and in return that you'll kind of provide them some kind of protection. But at the same time, it's often a bad deal for the people that are being ruled over, because they're ending up having to pay all these tributes to their ruler. But yeah, I mean, that's how like an actual conqueror would go about that. Whereas with the gang, they just want to pillage and they just want to take it. They just want to take the resources and then use them. And then I guess that's just it.
I mean, it's kind of weird on the way Master Blaster like bullies Tina Turner. Like, there's a dispute over who wrote literally like he makes her say that like out loud on the speakers across the town. Like when he says like who runs Barter Town, and then she has to say Master Blaster runs. Because they have got the ability to switch the power on and off, but like the little old man, he designed all of that. So I mean, in the end, the whole thing got again like blew up, and she says at the end, we will rebuild. But again, it's interesting to think about that. It's interesting to think. I think Tina Turner was quite a poor leader, but I'm not sure she was in a bit of a bind. To be fair. I think I'll hit some super chats then, if you're ready.
I'm ready.
All right. I'm just going to, first of all, everybody, thank you very much for joining us on this quite apocalyptic stream, but I think it's been a good laugh. Right. So we start with Irish Rose there for £5. Thank you very much. Ethno states are everything. I'm bothered. That's going to get us in trouble, isn't it? Piers Taylor. I think that's Australian dollars, which is very fitting for this stream. Cheers, lads. Well, cheers to you, Piers. Dale Newson, not having a great £5. Not having a great time now, so this is so well timed. Well, I mean, 2 hours of Apocalypse and Mad Max. I hope it cheered you up. Sergeant Steele for £10. Thank you very much. Sergeant Steele again for £2. Good evening, Morgoth. I hope all is well. Very well. Getting a bit late, but... Oh, this is an interesting one. Love the review, guys. Odds of a review of 7. I think that would be good to do at some point in the future. And I think I would try and get somebody on like Dave the Distributist for that one. For I was talking about that with some other people the other day. It came up in conversation. Where it like basically the take was that the Kevin Spacey's like sort of psycho was correct when he was criticizing like liberalism, you know, and he was murdering people based. That's even more depressing than Mad Max as a movie, by the way. But I think it would be good to get somebody on who is a bit more versed, a Christian, to come on and weigh in on those ones. So that's one.
That'd be fascinating. I'd like to have Dave on a stream for that one.
That would be very interesting to do, I think. So yeah, thanks. We'll see about that for the future. Dale Newson again, £2. Blood for the Blood God. No way, shiny and chrome. Right. Thanks. And Dale Newson again, thanks. Shout out to the chat this eve. You've all been really decent company. Oh, and the hosts too. Well, so have you folks. I'll have one last gander at the chat here.
I will bring up something somebody put in the chat at the very beginning, is a shout out to Canada's Mad Max, that being Mad Max Bernier, the leader of the People's Party of Canada. I'm not much into parliamentary politics, but if you're in Canada, they're the party to support. So shout out to Mad Max Bernier. And yeah,
there's a couple of pints came in on the coffee pot as well. So he has one from Hunky Haggis. I nearly forgot this one again. I actually replied to this on the app thing, and then he had to reply. He said, yeah, well, can you see, like, it's for the classic movies. And I was like, all right, I'll see. So he says, do you think if all mass media were to disappear overnight, TV news, social media, etc., people, NPCs, would revert to a more base, traditional position on the dissident right talking points? Do you think the system needs the constant bombardment to survive? I mean, yes, I do. And I think look, whatever you want to make about, like, Mad Max, the world of Mad Max, they're not woke and they're not being indoctrinated with, like, complete madness like we are.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree. I don't know if the NPCs would revert to a more sane worldview immediately, but without the constant bombardment of propaganda, it would happen, because you know, they just have to, you know, as the meme goes, they have to, like, change their chip every 2 weeks. So, you know, whatever the current thing is, they have to send that out in the media, and then get the NPCs on board with that. That would disappear. And I also think that in a now, if you're saying, like, in a world with no mass media but everything else is in place, or are we talking like a Mad Max collapse situation? Like, in a world like Mad Max, there's no way you'd be able to convince anybody of any of the you know, the progressive nonsense that they believe today, because you don't have a screen. First of all, you're not living a comfortable, safe lifestyle anymore. And secondly, you don't have a screen in front of you giving you a false reality. So yeah, eventually that would disappear.
It's kind of interesting, because we've touched on how sort of degenerate some of the villains tend to be. And so from a more, because these movies are old, it's interesting, because what he's kind of saying is that if you don't have, like, decent values upholding society, like, you'll revert to that. You'll revert to that kind of, you know, the ass chaps and the kind of homoerotic kind of weirdness of it all. Like, that's what's going to happen when civilization ends, for God's sake. But in reality, people in our society, people are being brainwashed into it. So another one. I'll not read out the name because it's a Gmail thing. As always, thank you, Morgoth and Endeavour. Thank you very much for the beer. Two possible coming soon attractions. The first, staying with the post-apocalyptic genre, 1988 Miracle Mile is a fascinating, visually different type of post-apoc film with images straight out of Hopper canvas. For something a little different, 1985 film After Hours. So much subtext in that one. Best wishes. After Hours rings a bell. I think I may have seen that. That does ring a bell. I'll have a look at that after the stream. So I think that's a wrap, everybody. It's basically, yeah, I remember that the right, basically Jack Donovan's worldview. But yeah, that's the wrap there then, folks. So thanks for tuning in, and take care now. we're running late. We've got classic movies right in prime time slot here, haven't we?
Yeah, hopefully nobody gets angry at us for this.
Strangely, in our circles, there's not many seem to stream on like Sundays and Saturdays and whatever. Where have you got any idea what we're doing next month?
Oh, I haven't decided yet, but I'm thinking something sci-fi. So I was thinking 2001 Space Odyssey.
Oh God, there's books written on that. All right. So thanks for that then, folks, and I'll catch you later.